Hi, Marty Lurie here, Brian Sabian. We talk a little bit more about the job of a general manager, and one of the things that that impresses me, and the things when we look back on your era of being a general manager, people made trades. Things happened every day. You look through the year that you had, you could make 70 transactions.
Yeah, it's funny now that I guess for this younger generation, how the game somewhat flipped is people forget the recent past, which was almost like today. Every single day you were looking to make yourself better.
Yeah.
Whether that was a waiver claim or you thought somebody was in harm's way to make a team in spring training, or more so as you approach the trade deadline. There really weren't any secrets back then. I think there was an openness or a camaraderie amongst the front offices, more so the GMs, that we could be really honest and upfront with each other, and there wasn't much fooling around. You knew whether you had a match or not. You knew how to go at somebody, and you had enough discussions. I do think the discussions back then were more year-round. You met up in the GM meetings, and as I told you, you had everybody really in the organization back then going to the GM meetings. Of course, the winter meetings. But then, I think prior to the trade deadlines back then, people were just more open for business. Let's put it that way. You weren't as guarded or afraid to make a mistake because it was a tried and true way to make yourself better. The trade front really was our go-to in a lot of organizations. You didn't live and die with free agents.
Yeah.
That just wasn't the nature of the beast.
Well, let's look at some of the deals you made. In putting the team together in 1997, that ended up being a playoff team, and how that came together. There's a few trades during the season you had things going on. Let's look at a few of the trades and take me through how they came about.
Well, you'd give me the printout, and I'd kind of forgotten, the tail of the tape, but Mark Gardner, November 9th, obviously pitched for us November 13th, infamous and famous Matt Williams trade, as we discussed in the earlier segment. Kind of a sleeper because he made the ball club. He was a six-year free agent. I'm pretty sure he was a non-roster invite. Was Rich Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Not too long after the Cleveland trade, we were able to acquire J.T. Snow from Anaheim and get some money back in that deal. Because obviously one of the reasons we traded Matt is things were tight with Matt, and even tighter to try to keep putting the ball club together. And Foster Massey and Alan Watson went in that deal. But as I look through, month by month, Damon Berryhill was signed as a six-year free agent. Henry was a free agent. The $1 million we got from Cleveland went towards being able to sign Darrell Hamilton. And then, of course, we rolled into the trade deadline, and we had the white flag deal, so to speak, with the White Sox, which was really a shot in the arm because that brought back pitching that we sorely needed, and we gave up quite a bit, obviously, in that transaction. But that was Alvarez and Darwin and Hernandez. Yeah. Right about that time, before I forget, one of the reasons Hernandez was in the deal, poor Rod Beck was kind of leaking oil. I mean, you couldn't take him off the mound. He was always ready and would pitch consecutive days more than probably anybody in baseball, more than he should.
Let's go through the White Sox trade, if you remember some of the details about it, how it came about, because you look at it at the trade deadline, and I realize the White Sox were, throwing it in. They're only four or five behind, whatever, at the time it happened. But what excitement in your office when this thing came about. How did that come about? That's one of your signature trades.
Well, it was really gamed out. We knew we had a match with the White Sox. Looking back at the time, Ron Shuler, I think, was comparing his organization, especially his major league team, as to the place and time Cleveland was at. Okay. And I want to say that they were in and around a handful of games out of the division league.
Right.
Now, as things would turn out, going back to the scouting days when Ron was an advanced scout for Oakland during the run of championship years, with the three consecutive going to the World Series, and then Dick Tidrow at the time was with me in New York. He also was an advanced scout. They really had a good relationship on and off the field. So Ned and I were in San Francisco, and we hatched the plan to send Dick kind of as the front man or the scout in motion to get him with Ron. And actually, Ron was very open to moving as much as we wanted to do pitching-wise, and we needed a couple starters, and we needed a reliever, and he had all that. Mm-hmm. But the irony was that's not normal business, because if you split those folks up, you get a chance to get more in return, and potentially with three different clubs. But from memory, Dick talks about it all the time, it was a grind because him and Ron had a ritual after these games that they were together that, you know, they'd go out after and they'd socialize or go to the places that Ron hung out in. But Dick didn't know if he was getting any traction or not until finally one of these nights, because he was there for a good period of time, you know, better part of a week, that Ron said, look, we'll sit down and we'll do some business, but I got to tell you, the guy you got to take first is Danny Darwin. If you take Danny Darwin and we figure that piece out first, then we'll see if we can get to Alvarez and Hernandez. And that's how it started, and, you know, the rest is history. And it was really the boots on the ground with Dick grinding it out with Ron and Ned and I kind of quarterbacking from San Francisco.
Right. Well, what a year 97 turned out to be. And giving up in that trade, Folk has given up. Then there was a shortstop who was pretty good. Was it in that trade?
Yes, Caruso, right, who was a young high school player from Miami that we had taken high. And I'm pretty sure he came out of San Jose with us. And we could look this up. I think he started the next year in the big leagues with the White Sox. If you remember the timing of this, kind of how we'd come off the disastrous 96 season, you know, almost like a season we had in 2017, 2018 here, we really needed to shift gears and get us more presentable and out of the second division. But especially as we marched towards the trade deadline, we were in a real race to win the division. And, oh, by the way, it was with the Dodgers. So I can remember Peter and Larry being very accommodating. And maybe because it was the Dodgers and that also was referendum time to try to get, you know, a stadium vote, that they let us go for it. And it was a huge shot in the arm. It really was, looking back. I don't know if you remember. I'm sure you remember that. We were on the road coming home to play that fortuitous but kind of quirky two-game series against the Dodgers, and it was sold out like a football game. And that was really, I think, when the club understood, the organization understood that this is pretty big, and, you know, we did need to win this division. And unfortunately, some of the transactions, especially whether it was Matt earlier before the season started, and in this case, you know, the White Sox deal, we gave them more than enough ammunition to take it home.
Well, the thing that impresses me, and I think that fans want to remember about you, is how you added to the team. I mean, there's a Brian Johnson who ends up with the big home run and the home run that clinches the pennant pretty much, but the big Dodger game. You picked him up, and you go down this list. It's the pieces that you put together that I think what separated you from everybody else, so you could put a team together.
Well, Brian was kind of a sleeper move, and I don't remember if it was Damon Berryhill or I don't see it on the sheet, but I think we traded for Wilkins. We signed Wilkins, I believe, in the offseason. There's another six-year free agent. But we had lost one of them, and so we were down to one catcher. And we desperately needed a catcher, and of course, I had history with Brian from the Yankee days, obviously going to Stanford, the Bay Area, knew him well. And, you know, the timing of him coming, and I think that the way he conducted himself, or especially handled the pitching staff, that he obviously didn't know.
Yeah.
And during, you know, the huge playoff type of atmosphere in September, which it was, because we boat raced the Dodgers to the last weekend, made a huge difference. But it's kind of, other than the home run, it was bigger than that. I mean, there was an acute need for Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, you put it together. Mark Gardner is one that jumps out at me as well. That free agent signing, Mark Gardner, what did you know about him at that point? Of course, he was with the Expos and a big curveball, but you did pick him up, and he became a very big part of the team.
Well, if you look at Mark's career, you know, he had a pretty good run in Kansas City and with the Expos and as a starting pitcher. And, you know, there aren't that many, what I would say, proficient or consistent performers that are starters that throw a curveball.
Yeah.
And not that he, you know, had to pitch to it or pitched off his curveball, because he could locate the fastball and had a lot of savvy, but he was one of the, you know, calming forces on that type of team, as well as, you know, as things rolled into him staying with the ball club, he became a bigger cog as we had some younger pitching coming up, and he kind of was the older brother and the guy that took everybody to lunch and kept everybody in line and got them to the ballpark early and got them to stay late. So, Gardy's one of my all-time favorites. I think one of the biggest laments I have about him personally is he never got the 100th win. He got stuck on 99, and I remember when we retired, we kind of laughed about it, but that's how fragile the game is.
Mm. All right, so it's 1997, and when we look back at your career, you've only had three managers in San Francisco. You've had, of course, Dusty and Felipe and Bruce Bochy. Let's go back to Dusty a little bit and your relationship with him and how he handled this team and how these deals were put together. Was he part of it? How did all that come about?
Well, first of all, when I came to the organization, it was basically fait accompli with, you know, through Peter and Bob Quinn, that Dusty was going to be hired, or probably was hired behind the scenes, and then Barry was obviously hired, signed not too far after the winter meetings of '96. And I really didn't have a day-to-day relationship with Dusty until the second half of '96, as I told you that I was given the opportunity because I was going to take over at the end of the season. That then I really spent every day around the major league club, and that's where we kind of, I guess that's where a relationship, you know, personally and professionally germinated, and it was important, and I think it made things a lot easier in the transition for a lot of reasons, that as a group, starting with myself now as the GM, to kind of roll into that off season and have some things in mind of things you wanted or needed to do. I do remember looking back that while we wanted to keep Dusty or, you know, the right people involved or abreast of what we were doing, it was a very delicate situation because you're talking about two cornerstone players, and we knew we had to trade one. And Dusty was very close to Matt. In fact, probably had, just in that window, a little bit stronger relationship for obvious reasons with Matt, in that you know, he was the hitting coach before he became manager, and then thus when he became manager, he was his third baseman and hit the middle of the lineup. So I think there was some shock and probably disbelief that this really happened or that it was Matt. Of course, Barry was new to the situation, having signed in '93. So.
Well, you had players, as I looked through the list, Bill Miller went back and forth. You brought Ellis. How about the Ellis Burks trade? I mean, hey, come on, Ellis Burks. And what impresses me about the whole list is you brought people in who made a difference. They weren't just filling roster spots. So, I mean, scouting, knowing what you needed. But look at the, look at Bill Miller. How about him going back and
well,
forth?
Well, going back to Ellis first, I can remember as we, you know, would day to day and week to week, you know, talk through our situation. We thought there was an acute need in the 98 season, and we didn't get to the playoff. Oh, excuse me, we got to the one-game playoff with Chicago, which we lost, so there was no wild card then, and we went home. But we thought we needed some more power. Yeah. And, again, it goes back to that, I guess, way of doing business at the time that, you know, we had appreciated Ellis's play and especially the hitter he was or the power that he had. From afar, really up close in the division. And then because of that, and we were adding an outfielder, we thought that Hamilton could be expendable. And that deal happened very fast. As I remember, that might have happened before the trade deadline. Maybe, because I remember talking about the trade during the All-Star break. And then Miller, you know, I look back, there's really two players that I wish we had had a different train of thought and for different reasons. Miller, we ended up moving him, as you remember, you know, before we got him back in a trade, which is ironic because about what I'm going to say, we didn't know how much power he was going to have.
Yeah.
And you know that time in baseball when there were a lot of home runs hit and a lot of runs scored by every team. I mean, you wanted your first baseman, third baseman, left fielder, and right fielder to be the run producers. And we weren't sure Billy was going to do that. We knew he was a good hitter. We knew he had a nose for an RBI and whatnot. But the irony, after trading him away, we got him back.
Yeah.
And still, I guess, didn't see the light or give him enough credit for just the type of player he was. And then the next thing you know, he ends up with Boston in 2004. He has a batting title. So, and the other one was Jeff Kent. You know, Jeff, we had a contentious year in 2002 as it started with him on the DL and all that crazy story that, you know, when he got hurt in spring training, et cetera. And I could see that he was just in a different place, and it might have been Texas in the taxes, or, you know, he did have that ranch, which he had bought, I think, when he was still playing with us, that he really, you know, had another opportunity. And I think we were a little bit slow in how that developed, so you know, that's all part of it. I always get a kick out of when somebody gets interviewed, you know, in any walk of life, you know, what would you do different? And they'd say, well, no, I think I did everything pretty good, or I wouldn't do anything different. That's a bunch of, you know, that's a crock of BS, as you know it, in baseball, because every day it's crisis management, and you got to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, the penny comes up on your side, sometimes it doesn't.
Sean Estes, how about bringing him in? And then all of a sudden he turned into one of your main pitchers. How did that come about?
Well, you know, another young talent, left-handed pitcher, with a curveball.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then you definitely had to have something in that relative era to take guys off the fastball.
Okay.
You had to have an equalizer. Now, everything wasn't around swing and miss necessarily, but it certainly was, you know, a factor. And you also wanted starters that didn't mirror each other.
Yeah.
And you know, Sean was a young talent, taken high in Seattle. We had a chance to get him, and you know, we seized on it almost much like, which we may or may not get to today, the Jason Schmidt trade. Yeah. You know, when that talent comes up or available, you seize the moment. I think in 99 we were faced with a similar situation. You correct me if I'm wrong. And people were shocked when we made the deal, when we traded for Leivan Hernandez with Miami. But when somebody like that comes on the market and you seem to have a fit, you find a way to get the deal done.
Well, you did. I think one of your legacy
pitching was definitely, you know,
a mantra for all of us, every organization.
Well, I think one of the legacies that you have, and going through these names, I mean, Levon Hernandez, I mean, these are trades. This is not free agent signings. This is trades. So you have to make a match with another team. You have to have credibility with another team. And I think that's the one thing about your legacy that's important to understand, is that you could make deals like that. People did trust you. All right, so Levon Hernandez comes over. Jason Schmidt is another one. But you pulled these off. You made that trade. I mean, the Jason Schmidt trade, when it was made, of course, he had been in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. He went to Pittsburgh.
And he perhaps was considered a little bit underachieving. Great stuff. But he really came into his own with the credit of Benny Santiago, who was the catcher at the time. But our advanced guy was Pat Dobson, and Pat was a big believer in the changeup. And towards the latter part, especially in 2002, Schmitty got the gumption to start throwing it to right-handed hitters. Now, I don't know if you'd remember this, but was very successful in the playoffs because at that time, there was kind of a pattern in how you use certain pitches. And Benny and Pat got him to use, the changeup against right-handed hitters, and it was a big difference maker. And then that morphed into that pitch being a huge out pitch, not only, to get an out, but to get a swing and miss or a strikeout. And that's the one thing we were very fortunate about, I think, through the managers, but more so. The common thread of theme was Dave Righetti. The guys that we ended up acquiring fit in nicely, but got better in more ways than one with us. And that's to the credit of our pitching coaches also.
Hey, Benito Santiago. How about that? It's another pickup you made.
Well, Benny, the first time around, I think it was St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
And I want to say it was Mirabelli and Bobby Estelea duking it out to try to be the starting catcher. And neither one of them have a good spring. And I was kind of getting frustrated. The team was on the road. And I got in a call out of the blue that he was working out in some obscure ex-big leaguers facility in Miami and really wanted to come into a spring training. I don't know where the team was, but I remember getting there late, not late for the game, but the game hadn't started yet, but it was getting closer to game time. And I called Dusty over and I said, look, I said, I'm not joking around, and I've had nothing to drink even though it's St. Patrick's Day. I said, but consider me officially nuts, and we've got a chance maybe to bring Santiago in. And I said, I'm frustrated with these two young guys that, we need somebody to take charge, and it's getting late. And what do we have to lose? He says, you know what? Go for it. I don't know what kind of shape he was in when he came in or how he got himself in shape. But, he ended up being able to start the season. And his time here was well spent in more ways than one.
How about Kenny Lofton?
Kenny, too, was an interesting story because we really didn't have a leadoff man.
Yeah.
And if you remember, Kenny was still in that zone of the ever-ready bunny or that energy that every team needs, especially from that spot, and then being a center fielder. And, again, fortunate enough to make a trade for him because he had a huge influence, I thought, in the 2002 year.
Yeah, tremendous. And the other one that jumps out at me, of course, the Marlins are letting everybody go, but how about Rob Nen? And I look at the names.
There's a reason for it, and I didn't know the chronology, but I can tell you firsthand, from your printout, which is interesting. Okay, you remember we have Hernandez in the deal, okay, closer, and we have Rod Beck still on the team. Well, at the end of the year, they both declared for free agency. And I didn't know if we had a legitimate chance to sign either one. I knew that Rod had roots and coming up in the organization. We might have a little bit better chance. I didn't know at the time that Hernandez, I guess, where did he sign in Tampa Bay, a big deal perhaps? And we were at the expansion draft, and Dick and I had gone for a walk, and came back, and we started talking, and I said, do you realize, you know, what date it is? No, it's later in the year. I said, we don't have a closer. I said, we got to get something done in a hurry. And we heard Nen was available. And it's funny. David Dombrowski has had success and is known throughout the industry, I would hope, in the game, that not only does he want to win, he's a pretty quick study in that he'll make a deal. Mm-hmm. And while he values the farm system, he's from the old school that the farm system's used to get you players and get you players from another organization. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know how we pulled that off because, you know, that was the under the pressure of the backdrop of the expansion draft, and we got it done. And, you know, Rob was one of our favorite relief pitchers here and, you know, personal friend. And huge as far as the timing of that and how that rolled into chance to win the World Series in 2002 with him.
We were going to touch on your first meeting with Peter McGowan because we were going through these trades, and it's almost like you're the owner of the ball club. I mean, you know, you're making these moves, and did you have free rein to do this? And let's go back to your relationship with Peter.
Well, Peter always wanted to be in the loop, and we kept him in the loop. And hopefully I'll weave this story where it has a little humor to it. When I interviewed, and there was a lot of back and forth between the Yankees and the Giants, and I finally had the interview in San Francisco. Peter came across as very, I don't want to say corporate, but, you know, really buttoned up. Yeah. And he was ready for this, which I didn't necessarily know what to expect. But I'll never forget that he had a yellow pad, legal size, that he went page by page. Mm-hmm. And we ground through this three-plus-hour interview. And I only bring that story up in that I really didn't know what to think at the time, and I actually kind of thought I might have perhaps even flunked the interview to a certain extent. But then as it turned out, once I got the job, Peter, no matter where he was, whether he was traveling or more so would take a weekend and nap, or no matter where the team was, rest assured on Monday morning that Ned, or then it became Bobby, would meet up with Peter in some form or fashion, either in the hall or he'd call him in, and he'd have his yellow pad because he thought about it 24/7. He was involved and engaged mentally in that right 24/7. He was never heavy-handed with us and never put us in a position that it was Mother May I, but, you know, he had a lot of ideas and he had a lot of questions. And I only bring that up is that his mind was really active, and I think because he was so abreast with the organization in real time and what was going on in the game, that when something came up and he knew a sense of urgency, that, you know, he was comfortable. Of course, you know, you build up, you know, those credits by how you end up in all these things you have to do in the position, including making decisions. And I don't ever remember once that he really was obstinate or wasn't in favor of us doing something if we could give him a credible, and it was never a long harangue. As long as we presented it in a logical fashion and what it meant, you know, present and future, he usually was all in, from my recollection.
Well, how did you and Ned get together?
Interesting story. Ned was with Chicago. Now that goes back to the time when I said that. You know, everybody really attended, including pretty much in the room, the GM meetings. And I knew Ned when he was, or had just become the assistant general manager with the Cubs. And through that, Tony Siegel had ended up going to Colorado in expansion with Bob Gebhardt. So we lost our assistant, and there was a little bit of a void, and I think that Tony might have had to leave before the end of the season. I'm not 100% sure. But we interviewed Ned, and Bob Quinn and I very much wanted to hire him. And I want to say this was 1994 or 95. And as it turned out, he couldn't find a way to make it work economically. And he couldn't move his family. Didn't want to uproot everybody from Chicago. And he had a great gig at the time with the Cubs had that experience. And lo and behold, we actually were in Arizona, Bob Quinn, Ned, and I, and he flew up for the day and was in complete shock with the Bay Area real estate prices. And pretty much came back from that trip defeated and sprung on us. I don't know if it was that night or the next day that we can't make this work. So I think he either told Bob and I, or maybe Bob separately, and I really thought he was going to be a perfect fit. Why? I'm not 100% sure why, but there was really good chemistry, and we knew that he was very diligent and very well thought of, and some of that comes from his PR days as he morphed in the assistant GM position. And finally I got him in. I said, look, you can't say no right away. I said, there's a way to do this. There's a way for you to stay in Chicago and commute. There's a way for you to, we can pay for a hotel room or get you, an allowance or whatever. And as it turned out, once he found out that he didn't have to run the risk of breaking up his family or his marriage, it got done. And the rest is history. I mean, it actually was a famous, troika amongst organizations, or I don't remember a team, with a GM, the assistant GM, and then their player personnel guy, Dick Diderot, were around for, so long and were able to have the kind of success that we did.
Amazing.
Guys want to leave, or guys do leave, and we didn't have that.
Well, that's really one of the purposes we're doing this, is to show the stability, because we look at 20 years of whatever, 22 years and the World Series appearances and the playoffs and everything, but you're 24/7 on this job, and the stability that you brought to it brought the ballpark and the World Series championships and everything else, and that's the beauty of going back through this and what it looked like. What happened during the strike? How did you handle that when the strike happened?
As we all know, and we were coming off 93, win 103 games, don't go to the playoffs, and then we faltered. Actually, just a shot in the dark. We ended up signing Strawberry, and he came back once he got in shape, got in a little bit better shape. And I don't know, maybe we were five games under 500 and playing better before the strike hit. But huge letdown, because I don't know that anybody in the game saw that coming. And then more so when you really knew that both parties meant business, or the owners or Major League Baseball was really upset they canceled the playoffs and the World Series, then now that's an issue. But it really became a huge issue in 95 as we went into that replacement spring, and that was a nightmare. I know that certain years took years off my life. That spring took years off all our lives. It just was an ugly thing to go through. And we were on the doorstep. We actually were back in San Francisco and playing a game over in Oakland when they ended up getting a new CBA at that time. And we had to bring everybody back. I think it was the Hyatt by the airport, and release them. And then there was like a dead period for a couple of days to let the dust settle. And then we came right back to Arizona and had to have another spring training. So, it was pretty maddening. I can't imagine, Dusty and I haven't talked really that much about that. But if I was a manager thinking I was going to have to go in the year with replacement players, or then to have a second spring and then bring your players back into that kind of fractured situation, it couldn't have been easy.
Right. Yeah, your stability is amazing, really, to weather all these storms. How do you even get replacement players? I mean, do you have tryouts?
Well, you had a laundry list, you know, because they were coming from your organizations, minor league players or other minor league players, six-year free agents, releases, et cetera. But there was so much chicanery going on where, you know, one guy would sign with three different teams, just no matter what fax he wanted to honor or what time you got a fax. It had to have been a nightmare for the commissioner's office. It could have been a real stain on the game, and we avoided it, but we really didn't, because you remember, it pushed a lot of people away from the game for a year or two, or maybe more.
Yeah. All right, we'll stop here. Boy, very good.
Very good. Okay, very good.